chapter 5 this evening, please. On a more serious note, if you do think to pray for Aaron's dad, he took a tumble and tore his ankle up pretty badly, so he is bedridden and recuperating from that. 1 Timothy chapter 5, and the passage that we're going to look at this evening is one we looked at just about a year ago, and when I actually began to think about doing the pastorals, I wondered what I would do about this passage. Would I just say to you, well, we dealt with that a year ago, or would I come back and look at it again? And we're just going to come back and look at it again. I hope that that doesn't cause any kind of an issue to you. But let's go ahead and stand, please. And we're going to begin in verse number 3. And we're going to read down to verse number 16 of 1 Timothy chapter 5. Honor widows that are widows indeed. But if any widow have children or nephews, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite their parents, for that is good and acceptable before God. Now she that is a widow indeed and desolate trusteth in God and continueth in supplications and prayers night and day. But she that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth. And these things give in charge, that they may be blameless. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. Let not a widow be taken into the number under 80 years old, having been the wife of one man, well reported of for good works, if she have brought up children, if she have lodged strangers, if she have washed the saints' feet, if she have relieved the afflicted, if she have diligently followed every good work. But the younger widows refuse, for when they have begun to wax wanton against Christ, they will marry, having damnation because they have cast off their first faith. And with all they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but tattlers also, and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully, for some are already turned aside after Satan. If any man or woman that believeth have widows, let them relieve them, and let not the church be charged, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. And let's pray. Father, I pray for your help this evening for us as a church, that we would take these instructions seriously, that we would understand them thoroughly and have your mind. And I pray this for us in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we know by now at this point in time in the book a couple of things. One is that the book is written to Timothy, who is the pastor of the church at Ephesus, with the goal of him restoring the church to sound doctrine. And I mention this again, and I'm really not trying to just beat this drum endlessly, but you are perhaps aware that there is a large movement among professing conservative believers that the only doctrine that really needs to be divisive is the person of Christ and the nature of salvation. And that if we're in agreement on that, then it doesn't really matter where our other differences are. And we can certainly get along with people with whom we differ. But the Bible takes the position that all doctrine matters and that no doctrine is to be dismissed lightly or casually. And the book of 1 Timothy is embracing the position that sound doctrine is not a matter of simply a textbook issue. We are not dealing with a Bible class curriculum in which we're going to talk about sound doctrine. There are a number of those. They're very helpful. But what God has in mind for sound doctrine are the kind of issues that are tackled in chapters 5 and 6. And Paul simply identifies a variety of groups of people. And he talks about the way they should be treated and the way they should be considered and where they fit within the church ministry. And verses 1 and 2 were the passage that we dealt with last week, right? Is how a pastor should relate to people in the congregation. Not everybody is the same age, but everybody is treated as a brother and sister, and nobody is to be attacked. In this lengthy passage, the group of people that is being addressed are widows. And when it comes to widows, Paul has two things that are very much in the front of his mind. One is the matter of church finances. I think sometimes we think that in the New Testament, nobody really cared about church finances. But Paul obviously cares about church finances. He mentions it a couple of times here with reference to this situation. And the second is, hard to find this, or we shouldn't be surprised by this, the other is sound doctrine. Right? Paul is looking at this as a duty that is levied at the feet of people on the basis of the doctrine that the Bible is teaching. And so you may have noticed there that the paragraph is pretty well mapped out for us, right? We see that it begins in verse number 3, honor widows that are widows indeed, and we see that it ends in verse number 16, at the very end of 16, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. This is what Paul, this is the context about which he is talking, those who are widows indeed. Now, one of the things that, and when we went through this a year ago, I probably spent a little more time on this, but one of the speculations is that among the turmoil in Ephesus that is going on doctrinally, which you can read about in the first chapter, that this is being fueled in part by these widows who are not walking in line. And possibly verses 13 through 16 are touching upon that very fact, that widows are contributing to the turmoil doctrinally by the way they are conducting themselves. And Paul doesn't want the church to in any way support or endorse them in their wayward behavior. We'll perhaps get to that. Okay? So Paul is very concerned that Timothy and the church understand clearly their responsibility towards people who are widows, or as we would call them, real widows. People who really fit widowhood as God would define it, not as culture would define it, maybe not even as Rome would define it, but as God would define it. Of course, marriage is as old as Adam and Eve, and in Paul's world, marriages are rarely, if ever, romantic in nature at their beginning. It is not the Roman way for the boy to fall in love with the girl and to woo her and for them to run away and live happily ever after. Most marriages were arranged affairs. Certainly the bride and groom provided some level of consent, but mostly they were orchestrated by dad. And dad was instrumental in arranging the marriage of his daughter. And in fact, the groom or the groom's family paid money for the privilege of marrying this young woman, the dowry. And the dowry literally refers to the bride price. How much is the girl worth? We read about that in the Bible when David romantically fell in love with one of King Saul's daughters and wanted to marry her. Saul said, "Here is the dowry, 100 foreskins of Philistines. That's the bride price. Bring the evidence that you've killed 100 Philistines, and you can have my daughter." In Genesis 34:12, Shechem offered to Jacob whatever dowry was required. "I want to marry your daughter Dinah. Tell me what the dowry is. How much do you want for her?" Right? It is almost inconceivable in the American perspective that a daddy would put a price on his little girl. How much is she worth? But the Greek historian Herodotus tells us that the Babylonians actually held an annual auction in which all of the eligible women were brought by their dads and a panel was assembled, and the most eligible girl was chosen, and she was put on the auction block first, and thereby the price for brides that year was established. She was the most eligible young woman. She commanded the highest price, and the price went down from there. You can just kind of imagine how this would operate, that, you know, you're tabulating how much you think you'd like the girl versus how much you're willing to pay to have the girl, as if buying a wife and buying a pickup truck are not very far apart. The women usually brought a dowry of their own to the marriage. Dad would grant to them some land or some money that, at least in part, was to protect her financially in the event of something going wrong in the marriage or her becoming a widow. But in most places, legally, the dowry then became the property of her husband. So there was always that consideration. And in Rome, under Augustus, widows, because widows were the most vulnerable people both in the biblical world and in Paul's world of the Romans simply required all widows under the age of 50 to remarry. They provided a window of time, and you just had to get married. Just pick a man and get married. We don't want widows in the public world. And so the Bible here is going to address something that is a very real thing, but the whole institution of marriage. And by the way, when you bring all that in, you can understand why the Bible admonition would be that husbands are to love their wives, because that's not necessarily where the marriage began. It literally began more in a transaction phase. And now you have bought a wife, and now you need to love her. So let's work our way through the text and see what Paul is getting at. In verse number 3, Paul makes the first of his major points, which is that real widows should be helped financially. Honor them, honor widows that are widows indeed or widows in reality. Now, that's the first use. And this, again, Paul is kind of walking through. In fact, if you'll just jump ahead to verse number 17, right in chapter 5 and verse number 3, when he talks about widows, honor them that are widows indeed. Honor widows that are widows indeed. When you get to verse number 17, let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honor. Elders, or in this case, the office holder, the pastor, is to be honored. Verse number, chapter 6 and verse number 1. Let as many servants as are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor. So Paul is going to bring this concept of honor into these three relationships specifically. How we think about widows, how we think about pastors, and how we think about what we would call employers and employees within the congregation. And everybody is to have their respective honor. In this case, honor is clearly a financial consideration. Real widows should be helped financially. Now, what is a real widow? Again, this is a real widow as God would define a widow. Paul is not suggesting that there, well, at least he's not necessarily suggesting that there are women out there who are really still married but pretending to be widows, so that they can get something from the church. Paul could do that, but nothing that he says leads us to that kind of thinking. Paul has some clear guidelines in mind as to what makes a widow a real widow, but whether or not she's pretending to be a widow is not one of them. And he is concerned that the church then, if necessary, rise up to its responsibility to provide financially for those who are genuinely widows. Verse number 5, how do you define a widow indeed? And we're just going to kind of walk through this, rather than, which I usually try to do, just walk through the verses in sequence. We're just going to kind of walk through it thematically as Paul deals with it. What is a real widow? Right? Paul, what do you mean by a widow indeed? Or perhaps even a better way to think about it, what does God mean by a widow indeed? Now, she that is a widow indeed and desolate, she is all alone. In order to be a widow indeed, she has to be genuinely all alone. They have no other source of support. Right, so we could, right, if you wanted to take a piece of paper and kind of outline this, right, we could make this heading widows. And then under widows, we could write that there are two kinds of widows. There are real widows, and for lack of imagination, there are not real widows. And then under real widows, right, we could identify what makes them a real widow and what makes some not real widows, right? So we have all these widows. Some are widows indeed. They are alone. There are real widows who are not alone. They do not count. It's not that they're not a widow, it's that they're not alone. And the church goes on in verse number 5. The church helps those who are truly widows. They are truly desolate, and they have these attributes. They trust in God. They continue in supplications and prayers night and day. And they are at least 60 years old. Verse number 9, let not a widow be taken into the number under 80 years old, having been the wife of one man. Well reported of, verse number 10. For good works, if she have brought up children, if she have lodged strangers, if she have washed the saints' feet, if she have relieved the afflicted, if she have diligently followed every good work. We'll come back and elaborate upon that a little bit. But Paul has a very clear picture in mind of what a real widow is for the purposes of the church. Who is eligible to receive regular support from the church, out of the church offerings? Real widows. What makes a real widow? Well, she is really alone in this world. She has no other help. And she really has a track record of godly living that is established in the eyes of the church. And she is at least 60 years of age, which to us, I'm not trying to be funny, to us, it is clearly, you know, I mean, we're all senior citizens at the age of 60. But in Paul's world, that was really of great age. That was really of great age. Archaeologists and anthropologists estimate that the average life expectancy of a man in the Roman world was about 25. Now, high infant mortality contributed to that, but by the time you were 60, you were pretty old. So we're not looking at some kind of situation, folks. And again, I'm not trying to be, I'm being a little bit facetious just to make the point, right? We're not talking about some young woman who's got 25 or 30 or 40 years of living ahead who finds this opportunity to be supported by the church so that now she gets kind of to live the life of a widow slash retiree and she doesn't have to do anything because somebody else is paying all the bills. And that's one of the things that Paul is very concerned about. And he's concerned about it because of the way it impacts church finances, and he's concerned about it because of the way it reflects upon the practice of the faith. It's unchristian. It's not the Christian way to live. So honor widows that are widows indeed. Verse number 3. But the primary responsibility, this is Paul's second point, in verses 4 through 8, is levied upon their family. The primary obligation for the care of widows is levied upon their family. If any widow have children or nephews, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite their parents, for that is good and acceptable before God. As she that is a widow indeed and desolate trusteth in God, continueth in supplications and prayers night and day, but she that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth. These things give in charge that they may be blameless, but if any provide not for his own, and specially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel." So in verses 4 through 8, Paul turns his attention now from the subject matter of real widows to the subject matter of the responsibility of the family for widows. So if they have children, verse number 4, or our King James Bible has the word nephews. But what Paul probably intended was grandchildren. The word is literally, if we were just translating the word literally without giving it a title that we're familiar with, is from born. If she has from born, if she has children and from born. Just as the word parents actually refers to born before. So if there is blood relative, if there is blood relative, this is their responsibility. And not only is it their responsibility, it is Timothy's responsibility to teach them that it is their responsibility. Notice the way Paul puts it. Verse number 4, "If any widow have children or nephews, let them learn first to show piety at home, to requite their parents, for that is a good and acceptable before God." Verse number 7, "These things give in charge that they may be blameless." So part of Timothy's responsibility was to inform families of their responsibility to their parents. They need to be informed that it is an act of piety. Look, folks, and this is, I concede that this is, in America, a two-way street. Okay? The history of the world has been parents have large families, and those children take care of parents in their old age, and that's pretty much the way the world has operated until really about the time of the Industrial Revolution coming to modern countries. And in America in particular, we have handed off the responsibility of aging parents to the government. And the government is now the prime caregiver, financially and locationally, of us in our old age. And the average American parent, and I would put myself in this group, right? I would look my children in the eye and say to them, "It is your responsibility to care for me in my old age. But I don't want to live with you. Because I don't want to live with them. And I love my children. But I happen to have a great fondness for being an empty nester at this point in time in my life." So in America, it really is kind of a two-way street. Most of us don't have that kind of mentality in which we all wish to live together as a family unit, and that is a bilateral agreement. The parents want it, and the children want it, and everybody does it. But look, folks, the Bible is very clear about this. You have responsibilities to your parents. Those are real responsibilities. And they can't be discharged through any act of Congress. You're responsible for your parents. This is the charge that God lays upon us. And that may mean digging into your own savings account. And that may mean taking the responsibility to see to it that they are cared for. It cannot in any way mean ignoring them or forgetting them. And I would just point you to the text back here, right? That God declares this in verse number 4, both a good thing and an acceptable thing to him. So to those of you whose parents are still alive, you need to begin to plug that into your thinking, that God finds it good and acceptable that you recognize that you have responsibilities to your parents. Particularly if your father dies and your mother remains alive. Particularly. Because, folks, this is a very gender-laden passage of Scripture here. Paul is not above using the word adelphoi, brothers, generic, humanity, right? Anthropos, mankind. But in this case, he's talking to boys and he's talking to girls. And so he's not talking about a single dad whose wife died. He's talking about a single woman whose husband died. And God's position is that you have an obligation, and it is good and acceptable to fulfill that obligation. And this is one of the reasons, by the way, I think, that Paul takes such a hard line in verse number 8. If any provide not for his own, especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. In other words, we come back to this, right? What is the faith? That is the delivered body of truth. That's what Paul's talking about. All the things that God has said cumulatively. And we don't just get to go to it. Well, I believe in Jesus, and so I've covered the faith, because part of the faith is caring for aging parents. And an expansion of part of the faith is caring for those who are genuinely destitute, materially. That is part of the body of the faith. These are things that God teaches. So, the responsibility falls primarily upon the parents, or upon the children, but verses 5 and 6 inform you. And I'm using that word because Timothy's task is to inform the children about their responsibility toward their widowed mother. But just because she's the widowed mother, that doesn't open the financial floodgates either. You notice, folks, that verses 5 and 6, right, those restrictions and admonitions fall within the framework of what Timothy is to teach to the children about their responsibility to their parents. So there are going to be, we will see, times where the church has that responsibility, where God expects the church to stand in and provide financially for those who are widows. But first, that responsibility belongs to the children. But it doesn't fall upon the children in an unrestricted fashion either. Right? The widowed mother doesn't get to live any way that she pleases and then hold her hand out and say, you know, I brought you into this world and you just need to give me money. That's what verses 5 and 6 are teaching. She that is a widow indeed and desolate trusteth in God, continueth in supplications and prayers night and day. Do you have a godly mother? Not a perfect mother, but do you have a mother that's endeavoring to serve the Lord? You have financial responsibilities to her. Do you have a mother who's treating her widowhood as the never-ending party? Verse number 6, she that liveth in pleasure is dead while she liveth. Right, there are always qualifications, folks. There are always checks upon human behavior. So we've got to talk about what a real widow is, and God is going to talk about what a real widow isn't. So if a woman is living luxuriously, in spite of the fact that her husband is dead, that's really kind of the idea there. Wantonly, she that liveth in pleasure. James 5 calls it wanton. Right? It doesn't mean that she spends the remainder of her life in mourning and in black and in sackcloth and ashes. But if she gives herself over to the pleasures of this world, it is not just her husband who is dead. She is dead while she lives. And again, verse number 7, these are things that are to be transmitted in a message by Timothy to the congregation from the Lord. Right? I mean, there's the sequence. The Spirit of God is breathing out the word. It is coming to us through the human instrument of the apostle. It is to be binding and authoritative upon all of the assembly as it is ministered by the pastor. So we have financial obligations to our parents because God says so. But those obligations are not simply open-ended. In other words, folks, and I'm just going to go back to the same illustration that I used a year ago. You have responsibilities to your parent, to your widowed mother, to help her financially. But you do not have a biblical obligation to support her alcoholic lifestyle or her drug-habited lifestyle or her sexually impure lifestyle. God is not saying, take my money and support your mother in her many paramours. But if your mom is endeavoring to serve the Lord, and if she has a track record of serving the Lord, then the obligation begins first with you. And failure to do this either indicates that you are an unbeliever or makes it look like you're an unbeliever, because you have most certainly denied a fundamental of the faith. So, which, by the way, with reference to then to the church, right? And this is particularly appropriate in America, in which churches are viewed primarily as social organizations, and in which one of the great expectations is that churches' primary responsibility is to minister to people materially. I got to tell you, folks, right? I'm going off on a little bit of a track here, but I'm not exactly sure that Paul would endorse the idea of the church just having a food pantry and opening it up to everybody who wanted to come in and get food. That's not the approach he's taking towards widows. Is your husband dead? Oh, well, then by all means, step right on up and let's give you some money. He actually has a rather stringent set of criteria to be put on that register. So that brings us to Paul's third major point, verses 9 through 16. Widows are to be honored. Real widows are to be honored. And the first line of honoring a real widow is her family. But it is possible that a church might have a real responsibility, and it needs to discharge that responsibility faithfully. A church is not really being mean-spirited and un-Christ-like. Right? I mean, because this is not an uncommon theme of the conversation. Westwood Heights Baptist Church, I'm calling to see if you can help me out financially. No, we really don't do very much of that. That's not very Christian of you. Well, right, we're not really governed by your assessment of whether we're being Christian. We're governed by whether God thinks we're being Christian. And God has put a pretty comprehensive set of guidelines in place. Verse number 9, let not a widow be taken into the number. That's a word that actually refers to some kind of a formality, that there is a list or a formal role, not R-O-L-E, but R-O-L-L, a role, like a roll call, an official list of people who are being helped that is kept by the church. Let not a widow be taken into that number under 80 years old. And in verse number 11, younger widows refuse. So if they're not 60, right? Automatic disqualification. I'm wondering if the church would be able to provide regular financial support for me. We would like your name and your date of birth. And if you're not the age of 60, we're very sorry, but we are scripturally prohibited from helping you. God says we can't. Our master says no. We've already talked about verses 3 through 5. She must be genuinely alone without any help in this world. We add to that verse number 9 that she must be at least 60. And we add to that verse number 10 that she must have a good reputation. Well reported of for good works. Well reported of for good works. So that if you went through the congregation and you said, tell me about Jane Doe. Oh, she's a good lady. She's a good lady. If she had brought up children, which certainly means her own children, and then if those are her own children, then they're responsible for her, and it could also mean, and probably does mean, in a broader sense, that part of her ministry has been a ministry to those that are younger. This is what Paul is going to tell us about in Titus chapter 2. That the aged women teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home. These are things that have been, we'll get to that passage, how Paul wants that done, but these are things that are to be communicated generationally within the body of the church, aged women to younger women. To go back to 1 Timothy 5:10, if she have brought up children, if she have lodged strangers, if she is hospitable is the idea, if she have washed the saints' feet, if she has been a servant in the church, if she have relieved the afflicted, if she has helped others in their times of distress, and if she have diligently followed every good work. And I think you know by now, folks, that Paul is fairly fond of, and in fact all the Bible writers are these kind of bullet point things, right? They're not intended to be lengthy, expansive explanations. They're what we would call bullet points, right? These little lists. In this case, a virtue list. Sometimes it'll be a vice list. Right, this little list. What are we looking for? What kind of woman should we help? Well, she's got to be really alone. She's just got to have no other help in this world. And she's got to be 60. And she's got to have a good reputation for being the right kind of believer, which is going to include nurturing others and financially helping others as she has been able, and to be hospitable to others. And then in verses 11 through 16, there are exclusions. Younger widows refuse. And just to give us some insight as to how seriously God takes this whole matter, folks, we really have something that is a rarity in the New Testament. This is really, in many ways, kind of jarring, because the New Testament doesn't do much of this. We have an arbitrary New Testament policy that all are excluded because some are offenders. So no one under the age of 60 can be included. Paul is not suggesting, folks, that every widow under the age of 60 is going to do what he is discussing in verse 11. But because some will, none may. As I said, it's really a rather abrupt position for the New Testament to take. It doesn't do that very often. And the exclusion is very clear. Verse number 11, the younger widows refuse, for when they have begun to wax wanton against Christ, they will marry. What does that mean? Right, there's just no way to dance around this, folks. Paul is dealing with a delicate subject delicately. He is making the point that younger women will give way to their sexual impulses at the price of their Christianity. And it appears that the context that Paul is concerned with, right, because we have to bring in other passages here. Is it wrong for a widow to remarry? And is God anywhere suggesting that a widow is remarrying only because of her lust? No. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul is very clear that as long as her potential husband is a believer, she can marry whoever she wishes. So we have to read a little bit into this passage, folks. We have to assume that what Paul envisions is this, right? The church is going to take your money and it is going to give it to a woman who is going to at least live like she is not a believer because her sexual lusts are going to drive her to marry anybody, even if they're not a believer. And we're going to have the church subsidizing the lifestyle of this woman. And that cannot happen. And that cannot happen. And so in verse number 15, folks, right? I mean, you see how God views this. And again, these kind of things, right? Because they appear to be almost pitiless and without mercy and so harsh. And we just have a hard time coming to the New Testament and thinking that God would ever talk to anybody like this. But here's what God said. Some have already turned aside after Satan. And we can't have a situation where they're receiving a check from the church and living for the devil. So nobody under the age of 60 gets in. Nobody under the age of 60 gets in. Just period. End of the conversation. Let's go back verse 11 to verse number 12 because it is kind of a verse that raises a lot of questions. But younger widows refuse, for when they begun to wax wanton against Christ, they will marry, which again, they're being controlled by their sexual lust. That's what it means. Having damnation because they have cast off their first faith, which means is their remarriage is sin. No, clearly not. Their remarriage is permitted. Romans chapter 7, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. So Paul and God are anticipating that out of their lust, they will marry an unbeliever. So they will cast off their first faith. They will abandon their faith to get a man. And then verse 13, they withal will learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but tattlers, also in busybodies, speaking things which they ought not, which is one of the reasons we speculate that some of the doctrinal controversy Paul is concerned with in chapter 1 is being advanced by some of the women, chapter 5. And so here is God's position then. I will there that the younger women marry, have, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully, which is Satan, live as a godly Christian woman and wife and mom. Some are already turned aside after Satan. Paul is concerned about women entering into marriages driven by something other than what drives God. God instituted marriage. Marriage is good. Marriage has its purpose. God gets to define that purpose. And people who live contrary to that purpose do not deserve the support of the church. They are living in violation of the faith. That should be cut and dried, but it now isn't always. So this is the general guideline for women. And actually, and there's some debate on that because Paul says, I will that the younger women marry. All Paul really said was young. And probably contextually, he's talking about the younger widows. Rather than younger widows going on the support of either their children or their church, they should get married. And they should become occupied with the things that occupy married women. Having children. Seeing to their responsibilities. And then there is one final exclusion. If any man or woman, and now you notice here that Paul has expanded, he has been talking specifically about widows. If any man or woman, just simply the male and the female version of the word believer, if the boy believers or the female believers have widows. So if any man or woman that believeth have widows, let them relieve them, and let not the church be charged. So again, Paul returns to this theme that the primary responsibility lies with the family. Now, let's I'm not saying this is true of you, but this is clearly true of the world in which we live. That we are content to let other people bear responsibility in our behalf. Let the government pay for it. Let so-and-so pay for it. We hand off that responsibility. But do you notice how we're instructed to think in verse number 16? Rather than, can I find somebody else to pay for this so I don't have to? The responsibility among the assembly is, I will pay for this so the church doesn't have to. If any man or woman have widows, let them relieve them, and let not the church be charged. This is part of the faith. Not the world that we have. Right? Because we're always, and I'm just using collectively, we're not you, Westwood Heights, but the world in which we live is always willing to let the deep pockets pay the freight. If it's not the government, let the big corporations pay it. Let the deep pockets pay it. So that it would be very easy to go, right? Let the church pay it. They got deeper pockets than I have. And what does God say? God says, no, you need to adjust your thinking. You pay it. You pay it. They're your widows. You pay it. Let the church do what it must do so that it may handle those who are widows indeed, so that it may care for those who are really widowed. So, here is an entire segment that is going to exist in the church, and very specific instructions about how they should think and how we should think about them and how their family should think about them in their state. What does this passage do for us? Let me talk generally and then specifically to Westwood Heights. Right? The Bible is very clear that there is a genuine obligation to help the needy, specifically widows. And so we're not shirking all financial responsibility. We are not looking to pass off financial responsibility to others so we don't have to bear it. But we are trying to ascertain where genuine financial responsibility lies. Primary helpers are the family, but the church might have a role. And those of us in the church need to look at the larger picture. Right? It's not just my mom has a need and you have more money. It is my mom has a need and I have an obligation before the Lord. And I need to think about how my conduct fits within the framework of what God calls his faith. And I don't just go off on a tangent and do that because she's old. There are a list of things to consider, and that means we're not necessarily bad, evil people for telling other people no. They will call us bad and evil. Right? That's stipulated. Right? Say to your parents, I love you, and if you change your lifestyle, I will help you, but I'm not supporting this lifestyle. That will probably not be well received. But it is nevertheless biblically right. And for the church to say, we just simply do not help in those kinds of situations, it is not something that God has for us to do, is rarely well received. But it is always right. It is always right. It is right and biblical to impose restrictions when giving away money. And folks, the passage is very clear that the driving force, and by the way, it's going to continue this mentality right into the next segment of workers. Right? That the driving force of a financial relationship is first of all a healthy spiritual relationship. That's the way the church is to think. So then what widows are entitled to money? Well, let's talk about your track record before you became a widow. And then when we get to the pastor and we talk about where the pastor fits financially, well, let's talk about what kind of a pastor he is. Because the material always is subordinate to the spiritual in God's economy. Always. Never first. Spiritual is always first to the Lord. And finally then, just because there is a pressing material need does not permit us to disregard the clear teaching of Scripture. Now again, this is for the assembly. Right? This is for us as an assembly. This Paul is not saying here, now individually I prohibit you. I would say to you, individually look at what the text is demanding of the church. But this is for us collectively. These are the guidelines that instruct us. All right, so a couple of things then with reference to Westwood Heights specifically. In light of this and based on track record of getting burned, right? We just don't take offerings for people anonymously any longer. Right? Not trying to embarrass anybody in their time of need, but we just don't take offerings and go, you don't need, we're just going to ask you to give, but we're not going to tell you who it's for. We're just going to ask you to give. We're just not going to do that because it seems to be inconsistent with the demands of Scripture in this case that there is a very real kind of relationship, so to speak. Okay? And this means that sometimes we get asked to do things that we just, and I mean we kind of in leadership comes to me or one of the deacons, we get asked about something and without making a big deal out of it or trying to embarrass anybody, we just know things and we don't respond to that. We're not trying to be unkind or arrogant. We just perhaps feel that it is inappropriate in light of what the Scriptures teach. And so we're not trying to publicize that, but sometimes we're asked and we don't act. We try to keep those to a minimum. Folks, I try to keep you aware of all the things that are going on that can do that. And then I would just point this out to us, folks. This injunction with reference to widows does not preclude us from occasionally helping people in unique situations and for other reasons. Right? The text here is talking about a regular amount of money that appears to be an adequate amount of money for the widow to live. Right? We're talking about somebody who is destitute, who has no other source of income. Right? So we're not talking about putting them on the church books for $50 a month. Right? We're talking here, the context seems to be a situation in which that widow is looking to the church for their regular support. And so, right? So there may be singular instances where we help somebody who's 59, or not necessarily a widow. That's a separate subject than what we're dealing with here. Okay, I'm going to stop there. All right, let me make you a couple of announcements. Choir.